Good to be out here with y'all again. If we can, turn back to obviously the book of Corinthians, which we've been going through. And to start out, I want to kind of recap a little bit. I know we're 10 chapters deep into it, and so sometimes it's easy to forget kind of what the first 9 chapters we're talking about. And so definitely want to look back at that if we can just for a second. And I'll give you, it's a very quick, shotgun outline, so it won't be too tedious. But if you look, basically what we've seen in these first 10 or first 9 chapters of Corinthians is we've gone through and we see Paul starting out in the first kind of 1 through 3 chapters talking about why he's here, who we are as Christians, what we believe in the gospel, how the gospel confounds the wisdom of men, and that it doesn't, the preaching of the gospel confounds the wisdom of men, that it doesn't make sense to the world, which I think we would all bear witness to, that if you try to, and not that you can't make the word or the study or the things brought forth in the gospel, it's not like it doesn't work, okay? It's not like it doesn't work with the world, okay? It just, when the world is viewing the gospel, it looks like silliness, or as Paul would approach it and say, that it is foolishness unto them. And it even appears foolishness when you're just out, I mean, by the sheer fact of just coming up and preaching, that somehow, when you have all the, I mean, if you look back in my mind, the way I think of that, if you look back in the Old Testament and you look how God displayed his power with, man, we parted a Red Sea and where manna's falling out of the skies and there's people wandering around a wilderness for 40 years and their sneakers never get old. I mean, like all these amazing things, and the New Testament heralding is going to come from preaching. And you say, well, that's a little let down. I mean, where's the Red Sea moment in the New Testament? Where's the, okay. And what I'll kind of get back to this as we get into chapter 10 is our Red Sea moment, our manna from heaven moment, our fiery mountain spitting thunder and Sodom and Gomorrah and all those amazing displays of God power. You know what ours is? The cross. Yep. Wrath of God poured out exponentially worse on the cross than Sodom and Gomorrah. Pain and suffering poured out there, long suffering and endurance poured out there, peace and forgiveness poured out there, an escape from death and hell poured out there. I mean, that is our Red Sea moment. And a lot of times we get disappointed in the New Testament, I think, or we get a little whatever about it, because it's like, well, I mean, even in the early church, I mean, they were speaking in tongues and all those things. And I think God's kind of message to us now is this: why do you still need that when you have the gospel?
Amen.
Now, in the early churches, in Corinth in particular, we noted at the very beginning, they poured out an overabundance of spiritual gifts at this church because you had a predominantly, I would say, a massive majority of Gentiles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people who never, they had known the oracles of God. And you can't open up the Old Testament and go, well, here's Genesis chapter 3, and here's Isaiah chapter 7, and here's Jeremiah chapter 40, and Ezekiel chapter 39, and there's Christ. Now believe, accept, repent, be baptized, and let's follow after him. They don't have the Old Testament to go off of. So instead, they're looking at it going, well, I mean, we've got all these other gods over here, and we believe that if I give this sacrifice to this one, it's going to rain, and I give this sacrifice to this one, I'm going to be blessed with fertility, and I give this sacrifice to this one, I'm going to get a new job. What does your God provide for me? Boom, I'm going to have 3,000 people standing in a population all speaking different tongues, and one man deliver a message, and everyone hear it. Beat that. That's my power. So that's the kind of things that they had going on at Corinth. And so he kind of lays that out. Y'all been blessed to have these gifts. You've been blessed with the gospel. The rest of the world is not blessed by this. There's people outside who are not believers in Jesus Christ who this is just a bunch of hogwash to. But you're blessed to see the truth of God. And a lot of times we have to reiterate that because what we get into thinking is, well, of course I've got the Bible. Well, of course I know it's the truth. Well, of course I believe all this stuff. And it's just old hat and I lay it on my coffee table or my nightstand and I might read it every now and then and that kind of thing. But what Paul was pointing out in the first chapters here was the thing that you're holding in your hand, the word of God that you have been blessed to see that other people have not. You need to treasure it because that's a gift from God that you have that other people don't have. And we have to come to the conclusion, and we have to agree with the conclusion that my life is better after Christ than it was before Christ. And a lot of times we have the idea, well, you know, it was pretty sweet when I was back and I could get drunk and get high and sleep with as many women as I wanted to or do whatever I wanted to in college or high school or wherever. And that was just such a sweet life. And now I've got all this rigorous things from God telling me I can't do this and I can't do that. Life is so humdrum and there's no more joy in it. Okay, come on. Let's get real. And also, just if you want a big picture on this, if you really want to come down to the red line on it, I think we would all agree that heaven sounds like a much better place than hell, right? I hope we'd agree with that. If you don't agree with that, we may need to bring you up in a little discussion. But the first three chapters are basically talking about that there's this great thing we've all been blessed to know. We have the truth. God's given us the truth. He's blessed us with this. He's blessed us with what should be unity. And what we find in chapters 1 through 3, 4, 5, and 6, there's not a lot of unity at the church at Corinth. They had split apart. They started worshiping the preachers, worshiping that Paul was better than Apollos, and Apollos was better than Peter, and Peter was better than Paul. And we're going to put a lot of weight on them. You saw that in chapter 4, he really hits home at there's an equality amongst ministers. That whereas there's a different gift, whereas God may use Adam in one way and use Brother Charles in another way and use Brother Derek in another way and use Brother Sonny Piles in another way. And everybody, you know, sometimes when we get too much carnally minded, like to, you know, pull out those differences and being like, well, that's why this one's better than that one. Okay. Yeah. But what God tells us and what Paul tells us in chapter 4 is there's an equality amongst the ministers, that God called Adam just like he called Brother Charles, just like he called Brother Sonny, that he called them all the same to the same purpose, and it was to preach the gospel in the ways that he called them to do it, but they're all the same in that. And you don't prop one up above another, you don't put one down below another one, they're all equal in what they've been called to do. And so there's an equality amongst the ministers, but also in chapter 4, there's the commandment, the admonition, you don't prop them up, but you definitely honor them for what they're doing, because as Paul would go through there, he says, look guys, I've been shipwrecked for you, I've been beaten because of you, I've been whipped because of you, I've been snake bit because of you, I've been burned because of you, I've been stoned because of you, You should at least, you know, not that you're going to prop me up and put me on a pedestal as almighty Paul, but you should acknowledge the fact that I'm not doing this for my own glory and for my own praise and for my own plaque on the wall or my name on Facebook or whatever it may be. That's not why I'm doing this. I'm doing it for the glory of God and for your growth in him. So he says there's an equality in this. Don't prop up the minister, but definitely honor the man that is doing the job because he's called of God to do that. And it's not an easy gig. Chapter 5, he goes in and starts kind of laying out, expounding on what the difference is and what the disunity of the church creates. You have a group of people over here more than likely, but in particular, he focuses on one and says, you've got this kid, he's sleeping with his stepmom, is what we hope it is. He's sleeping with his stepmom, that's a little gross and weird, that's fornication, get him out of there, let him get corrected, need to get that situation fixed. It's not good that you like that, it's not good that you're puffed up about that. This fornication has to stop. And he goes through and then explodes it into all fornication. Make sure, you know, you're living the life that you're supposed to live and why that is. Okay. And chapter 10 kind of gets back to that. And we're going to look at it. But he goes on into chapters 6 and 6. He then goes back to disputes. You're fighting brother against brother. You're taking them to law. You're going to the courts instead of handling this business inside the church, which you should be able to. Because if you've been given wisdom of God, which we all have, even the least among you should be able to kind of mitigate a dispute inside the church. I win my Scrabble word for the day. Chapter 7, he then goes into, again, disunity. A lot of the causes of the fornication amongst them is because they had this warped view of marriage and what it meant. And probably had a very, as very much probably that went along with their pagan worship that they used to be in, okay, at Corinth. You had a lot of wife swapping and a lot of mistress carrying. And so he goes in and tells you what marriage is supposed to be. And that if you're single, you live in your singleness to God and you quit worrying and lusting and trying to get out after everybody else. And he says, and if you're married, then you're supposed to stay married to the one that you're married to and you shouldn't be going out seeking other people. That window shopping is not acceptable and just looking but not touching is not acceptable. That there is a marriage and your covenant and your promise to this one person who you have said those things before God to, and God wants you fiercely devoted to them, because in fiercely devoting yourself in marriage, you're fiercely devoting yourself to God. And that everything, whether you're single, you're devoted to God. When you're married, you're devoted to God. All in all, guess what? You're devoted to God. But when those things break down and those systems break down, what leads to is fornication, which is an exact opposite of devotion to God. Chapters 8 and really in 9 too, he started kind of getting into idolatry. And it's something that if you kind of read through it all in one chunk and not split up the chapters as I've kind of done, but when you read it all together, you see in chapter 8, he specifically talks about idolatry. And then he talks about how, you know, it gets into some things about eating practices and all this stuff, and talking about how, you know, again, what Romans 14 says, you don't judge another man's liberty. Eating something offered to an idol is not sin in and of itself. That, as we know, that's all just kind of phony anyway, because the idol is nothing. It's just a piece of whatever, and it doesn't have any power in and of itself. But for conscience sake of your brother, if your brother is offended by that, you are to kind of humble yourself and get off your mighty high horse of, well, I've got such liberty, and I'm stronger than you, and I'm wiser than you, and I'm better in the scriptures than you, and I can do these things, but you can't because you're weaker. And once you get ascended to my level of awesomeness, then maybe you'll be able to do these things too. And said, no, he says, no, you need to humble yourself down and actually go to that brother. And if that means that you don't eat meat for the rest of your life because your brother's offended by it, well, then don't eat meat. It's a higher, weightier thing to offend a brother and cause them to stumble than it is for you just to kind of change your diet. Okay. And of course, that went into other things. But then he goes into chapter 9, and we talked a lot about chapter 9 and finances and giving and how the minister is to be a full-time minister. He shouldn't have to be working to make his own wages, because that the idea is that the God, the man of God who's called to be the man of God at a church, is called to be a man of God who should be studying and staying in the Word, and that his life should be in the Word of God and not wrapped up with 40 to 50 hours a week of a secular job. But something that if you don't, again, the reason I wanted to go back and kind of recap it is because 8 to 9 is not necessarily splitting up, okay? The thoughts from 8 to 9 don't necessarily separate.
Right.
And really, all of this doesn't really separate. There's sometimes, like, we're going to get towards the end of 10, and you're going to see it kind of changes a little bit, especially when he goes into 11. But what he kind of gets into with this is, and from 8 to 9, basically, idolatry is the same problem here. Okay, reason that your minister is not being provided for is because you're giving your money somewhere else. Okay, and that's what we're going to get into that in chapter 10. But that same idolatry thing came into chapter 9. It wasn't just the fact of, you know, going out here and propping up a little Buddha and, you know, burning some incense, bowing down to him or whatever, or Vishnu or whoever else you want to stick up there in your little cubbyhole. It wasn't necessarily that. That was obviously going on. But the thoughts carry through to that is you're taking your money and the provision for the man that's called to deliver unto you the heavy, weighty matters of the gospel, you're robbing him of that, which means you're probably giving it somewhere else. And then he gets into chapter 10. And in the last, really the verse in chapter 9, verse 27, but I keep under my body, and basically he's saying, I keep my body under submission and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. So Paul says, me of all people, I want you to understand that when I'm preaching these things to you, I myself am doing them probably to an extreme. He says, because of all things, what I don't want to do is to stand up here. And I think this goes with any minister. You can't stand up here and be a minister and talk about how you need to be able to control your tongue, or how you need to be loving to your wife, or loving to your husband, or whatever it may be. You can't get out here and say, well, you know, you really don't need to commit fornication, and I'm over here committing fornication. Okay. I can't come out here and say, well, you need to control your tongue, you need to control how you speak to your wife, and you need to love your wife with a fierce passion and love, and then get out there and I'm not doing that. So Paul says, I keep my body under subjection. I keep myself under the subjection of God. I make my body, and he'll use other places in Peter and Timothy and other places, he'll talk about it, your body as being a vessel of honor. And he says, and every man should know how to possess his vessel. Okay, so the idea that kind of what Brother Charles hinted at this morning, which it kind of goes with a greater theory or principle of mine, that there's no excuses in the kingdom of God. You can't look at it and go, well, I just have an anger problem and I just can't get over it. Or I just have a problem with, expressing myself to my wife. Or I just have a problem with, I just can't help that I'm mean. Or I can't help that I'm abusive. Or I can't help that I have all these problems. That's just how I am. which is just my favorite catchphrase at this point in time in my life. Because all over the media, and with everything going on recently, and you probably know all about it, but, you know, in whatever it may be, okay? And the hot topic today is obviously homosexuality, and that's the big thing, and that's the big controversial issue or whatever, and that's the most brought up and railed against. You know, here's the problem with that. That in particular, plus that is just one branch on the tree, okay? With idolatry and fornication and anger and everything else, it's just one of the of many branches. But what it comes from is a root of a wicked, broken, sinful heart. Now, we all struggle with these things. Some of us struggle with anger problems. Some people struggle with homosexuality problems. Some people struggle with drunkenness problems. Some people struggle with drug addiction problems. Whatever the problem may be, the excuse when you are a born-again believing child of God that this is just the way I am and I can't help it, this is the way that God made me and there's nothing I can do about it and I'm just living as God made me. Well, that doesn't work. You know, when we talk about it with homosexuality, they'll use that as an excuse of why it should be honored or why it should be accepted. And the problem with that is that we don't accept that argument with a drunk, and we don't accept that argument with an abuser, and we don't accept that argument with a murderer. So I don't know why we should accept it with that. Now, I'm not railing on that, because it, just like I said, it of all things, you know, I think sometimes the church, you know, we zero in and get on hobby horses all too often, and now, you know, the hobby horse is the, gay marriage and yada, yada, yada. Okay, yeah, but we do it, we do understand that we're still murdering 300,000 babies a year. So let's blow this out. Marriage, you know, and this is completely off subject, but gay marriage being the hot button church issue brought up everywhere is, you know, here's the reality of it. We don't, the church doesn't control the marriage anymore because we let the government issue the marriage licenses, okay? So if the church really wants to have overreaching authority on who can get married, well, then we should have never let the government say who can get married, okay? But when the government says that, and the government is a secular, not a church institution, then they're going to do, I mean, they do all sorts of stuff. They say that people can and can't have guns. They say that people can and cannot drink. They say, I mean, they say a lot of stuff. They legal, I mean, this is just one little stupid thing with them. It's just a mountain of stupidity, okay? But now on the other side of it, the church will get off onto that one side. And then the other side is, well, do we forget the fact that of a weightier issue, we're murdering babies? And people will say, well, it's not a baby till yada, yada. Okay, you know, 300,000 is the large statistics. I'll give you another very large statistics. 30,000 of those babies are third trimester late term abortions that are legal in places like Oregon. If I remember my statistics right. So 30,000, okay, blow it out, all right? Take, what is that, 270,000? Okay, we eliminated 270,000 of those, not what I believe, but 270,000 of those don't count because they're before the third term. Just third term alone, 30,000 babies who have lungs, hearts, brains, movement, can react to pain, have emotion, all these things. That's still going on, and the church is silent on it to most degree. The church has just kind of let it pass by. Oh, well, no, we got to focus. This is gay marriage. This is a big issue. This is something. Marriage is not our realm anymore. Marriage inside the church is our realm, but marriage in the mass populace, we have no control over it. The government's in control of that. We let them have it. So, I mean, if we're really focusing in on it, let's get real. There's bigger issues with this. So that's just one of the branches coming off of all this. But what Paul says in all of this, I, being a minister, bring myself under subjection in all of these things. And then he goes in, moreover, brethren, I would not that ye should be ignorant how that all our fathers, now talking about the Hebrew fathers, were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and the sea and did all eat the same spiritual meat and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Now, here's a beautiful thing that Paul does. Now, he's preaching to a majority of Gentiles, but he starts bringing in the continuity of the scriptures, because what you have is you have this, in my mind, you have this division, especially, we know there's division amongst it. Some of them liked Apollos, some of them liked Paul, some of them liked Cephas or like Peter, and then some of them just said, well, I'm just of Christ, you know, I'm the non-denominational, I'm of Christ, I'm unaffiliated, as, you know, O Brother Where Art Thou will say, I'm unaffiliated. But with all this, what you see is you get the same picture that people like the Gentiles were probably looking and say, well, we're not of those Jews. Not those ignorant Jews who rejected Christ. We acknowledged Christ. So we're not of those Jews. And, you know, Paul's written in other places, like in Romans and places like that where he's written, which more than likely all these letters were circulated around and got around to the churches at some point in time. But, and some of that's probably speculation too, but what you have is Paul's already said a couple of times about how there's this blindness, you know, like Romans chapter 9, 10, 11, a blindness on the Jews because they rejected the Christ and all these things. So you can get this picture of the Gentiles sitting back there saying, well, we are the ones that accepted Christ. We didn't reject the Messiah. We are the ones that followed after him. That's why we're getting all these spiritual blessings. That's why we're, the new age. We're the hot stuff right now. And what Paul says is, I don't want you to be ignorant. Because the Jews, going all the way back to when they were led out of captivity in Egypt, when the nation was established, when the law was given, at those kind of things, Paul says there's a continuity between then and now. Mm-hmm. That's somewhere around 3 to 4,000 years, okay? So Paul is saying there is a continuity. You know, we love to use the phrase, it's used many different ways, but Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. God, the same yesterday, today, and forever. We talk about how God does not change, that from Old Testament to New Testament, he does not change. He's the same God with the same plan, with the same idea, with the same way of salvation. It's the same God, the same plan that went all the way back before the world began, as Ephesians would tell us. So here he says there's a continuity to it. The same Jews who either you are saying, that you're better than them because they were Old Testament, you're New Testament, they're old school, you're new school. What he says is they're the same. And he says, and you know what? They had the same blessings that you have. He said they went through the same sea, you know, went literally through the Red Sea, which is a form or at least an idea, you know, a metaphor, allegory, all these things. The Red Sea is a type of baptism, okay? It's a type of baptism, all right? Not a literal baptism. But what he says here is that they were all baptized in the same way unto Moses. They went through water just like y'all go through water. They had this cloud and this, they lived under the cloud in the pillar. And, there's all these things that you can sit down and if you ever want to study it, you can go through and people will go through and allegorize and spiritualize probably to a bad degree, but what the cloud and pillar was. You know, there's a cloud that, you know, had a cloud by day, and it would light the way for the children of Israel. It would darken the way for the enemies following them. The Red Sea would let you pass through it, but it would fall in and kill all your enemies, signifying that you passed through the waters of salvation, and you came back, and the waters killed your enemies, which were death and hell. I mean, all this stuff that you can really get some good spiritual just mumbo jumbo out all of it. Can't tell you 100% what exactly each thought pattern was of Paul here, but he's saying that they all went under the same thing that y'all went under. You know who it is? Christ. You say, well, Christ wasn't in the Old Testament. Well, Paul seems to believe differently. Paul seems to believe that the spiritual rock that followed them, that delivered the life-giving water to them while they were in the desert. I mean, again, you just allegory after allegory. The life-giving, water-giving rock that followed them while they were murmuring and complaining in the desert and could find no meat, could find no water, he says that spiritual rock that followed them was Christ. And I don't think literally there was a little rock hobbling around behind the children of Israel. So he says, though, it's the same kind of metaphor in all of that was following them, that Christ was with them. Christ was in their baptism back then. Christ was in their life-giving water back then. Christ was giving them their food and their bread. Christ was giving them their light and their protection. Christ was with them, and they experienced the same Spirit of God that we experience today. He said, so there is no difference in that. There is no separation in that. We are all one in that. And the reason he precurses that is because he then goes on. And also, just to, again, because of these teachings in these first few verses, what we grab is because people always, you know, you get the idea, well, God did things differently in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll give you that to a degree. God explained his plan, so to speak, differently. And what I mean by that is that he used the law And he used the teachings in that, as the Galatians would say, that the law was our schoolmaster to lead us to who?
Christ.
And so he used the law in the sacrifices and the tedium in the temple and everything. And he will, and I can't even think of the spot now, but he will talk about how the picture of everything that Moses and them built in the temple, the picture of everything that David got for the temple, the picture of all that was a representation. It was given by the Spirit of God reflecting the greater temple, which is in heaven. Okay, so all that, you know, David didn't just sit down one day and say, you know what I think? Gopher wood. And I think we should have 12 pillars. And I think we should have a nice, pretty curtain guarding everything. And let's build an ark. And I don't even know what an ark is, but let's build one. And we'll cover it with gold. And he didn't come up with that. Those were plans and things given to him by God. So, you know, with that, what you see here is this kind of, again, this picture of all throughout the ages, the same narrative has been spoken since Genesis chapter 3, really. Since Genesis chapter 3, when God said, I'm going to have a seed of the woman come, he's going to bruise your heel, the serpent's going to bruise your heel, but I'm going to smite his head or crush his head. That initial prophecy from there going forward, from even before time when God, you know, chose us, before the world began, the same story has been told. There's not been a different way. The law didn't save you in the Old Testament, and now Christ saves you in the New Testament. It wasn't by some kind of special sacrifice in the Old Testament. Now in the New Testament, it's something different. It's not. It's the same story. Same story. And in the Old Testament, it was just explained in a little different way. So then he gets down here, and the reason that we want to really get to this is that getting in verse 5, he says, but with many of them, God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, these things were our examples to the intent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. So now we get a different picture of it. Now, all these things happen in the Old Testament, and Paul says they've been brought forward. And the reason we even keep bringing them up today is because they are our examples. You know, people will say now, well, we're in the New Testament. We don't need the Old Testament anymore. The God of the Old Testament was so mean and harsh and burning people with fire and brimstone and turning them to pillars of salt and stuff. We don't like that God. We like New Testament God, which is a different God. And he's fuzzy and lollipops and it's different. It's all about grace and love and harmony and peace. And no, the same God. Had a little different method of interacting with his people at that point in time. But you know what? There's still judgment and wrath, as Brother Charles talked about this morning, that's poured out on us. Maybe we don't get turned to a pillar of salt. I wouldn't try it. I wouldn't tempt him. You know, tell him, well, you can't turn me to a pillar of salt anymore. And I will, you know, come by and, you know, we'll put you on some beans, okay? But what he says was that we look at that and they are now our examples. We look back on him. We look back on him and we're talking about school lunch food. Yeah, yeah, the lunch food. Got to have some salt in it. Exactly. So what you have is he says, these were our examples. Look back at them and see what happened. They enjoyed the same spiritual blessings that you have. Now, in one way, they did not have the completeness of the gospel. And in a way, they did not have the full mysteries of the gospel or the full mysteries of God plan laid out yet. But you know what they had? They had knowledge of the one true and living God. They had his word laid out for them, pinned on stone tablets. They had a great leader in the name of Moses and other great men of faith, as he talked about this morning from Hebrews 11, that were their guides and their leaders. They had prophets. They had judges that were all given to them by God. So they enjoyed. They went through the Red Sea. They had the pillar of cloud and fire. They had the water from the rocks. I mean, they had all these spiritual blessings. And he says, but there were those of them that even with all that, they fell. Mm-hmm. Now, Paul will tell us again over in Romans, I may be misquoting it, but over in Romans, you know that not all of Israel are of Israel. Okay? So there's obviously that kind of group within the greater nation of Israel at that time, but they weren't children of God. They're not going to follow after the spiritual things. They want the golden calf because they have no desire for God. But you also have probably, more than likely, children of God. I mean, you look at Aaron, and you go back and you read back over in Exodus, and Aaron's the first one that when they start murmuring about Moses taking too long up on the mountain, you know, we're just getting the first law ever laid down by God, and we want, you know, very much I think Aaron was in that, and Israel is a very good prototype of America. You know, we want everything now, fast food kind of service stuff, and we want a fast food God too. And so when he's going to lay out his law, the first time he's ever laid it out and, you know, pinned out here in the world, and we want him to wrap it up in somewhere around a day or two, or else we're going to get a little impatient. So here, and you go back over to Exodus in that story, and you see Aaron's the first one that's like, oh, y'all want gods? Okay, well, yeah, throw me some gold. Give me your earrings. Pluck all that stuff up. I'm going to melt it down. We're going to make a nice golden calf. Y'all want gods? I'll give you gods. Let's go with it. I like this idea. So there's people, even good, godly people, who can fall into these temptations, okay? And so he says, look at the Old Testament, look at them. Don't cast it off as that they were just a bunch of ignorant Jews. Remember the fact that they enjoyed spiritual blessings. Even to some point, they got to see the Red Sea parted, which, you know, in some people's minds today, well, where's my Red Sea moment? Where's my, you know, where's my manna from heaven moment? You look at them, you say, well, the Israelites had all that. I mean, they got to walk through a sea. It was split in half. They got to watch this pillar of fire that followed them and somehow led them through the wilderness. They enjoyed all these spiritual things. They enjoyed seeing the presence of God come down on a mountaintop. Yet they fell. And we always look back and say, oh, I would never do that. I would never fall if I saw all those things. If the Red Sea was parted before me, I'd be a devoted and soul child of God for the rest of my life, and I'd never wander and never stray. And maybe you wouldn't. But I have a feeling that even when we have something as monumental as the cross, we still fall. So he says here that they weren't that these were examples for us, and he goes into verse 7, and we're going to see how quickly we can run through this. You get down into verse 7, he says, neither be ye idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Now, what you have is in verse 7, 8, 9, and 10, you have four different kind of pinpoint examples laid out, and as you will notice, they kind of go right back and they reiterate things from chapters 7 and chapters 8 and chapters 9, okay? Things like fornication and idolatry and murmuring and tempting God. So in verse 7, he starts out and he speaks of idolaters, and if you flip over to Exodus chapter 32, because that's where he quoted from, Exodus chapter 32, you have the story that I just read about or just talked about. And what he says is, this is where they murmured, Moses is taking too long, you know, we've been sitting in line for 30 minutes now, and we want our Big Mac, and Moses isn't coming down off the mountain, so we need to do something about this. We need to get us a God, because we're too busy, can't wait on this God, okay? Verse 2 of chapter 32, and Aaron said unto them, break off the golden earrings which are in your ears of your wives and of your sons, which is kind of weird, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people brake off their golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at the hand and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And when Aaron saw it and built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. So what you have is this picture of they're waiting on God. God's taking too long. Give me a golden calf. Okay, I got a golden calf. I'm going to wake up early and we're going to make some sacrifices to this golden calf. And then we're going to spend the rest of the day sitting around feasting, whoring, playing, and doing whatever we want to do. And what Paul says when he comes back to 1 Corinthians, he says, don't be idolaters. And they say, well, that's an easy one. We don't have a golden calf in our house and don't have any desire or any wish to do so. So don't be idolaters. Man, we're hitting it. We've got that one in the bag. Except it's not that easy. Because in America, and what's interesting is, as I'm listening to a podcast by a pastor out of Seattle, and he's doing a sermon series through the Ten Commandments, and you know, he hit on the idolatry commandment, and he relays a story, and again, it's third or fourth hand story, but he relays a story of going over to India, where you sit there and you're walking through these villages, and you have literal idolatrous temples. I mean, you've got Vishnu and all these other little Buddhas and Hindu gods, and you have these little temples, and you're sacrificing chickens, and I mean, they're doing old school idolatry just like you would expect. You know, and he speaks to one of these local pastors' wives, and she says, you know, I've been to America, and he says, oh, really? You know, when do you plan to go back? And, you know, and he relays how sickened he is by all the idolatry in this country. And he says, her response to him was, well, I don't think I'll go back to America because I can't stomach the idolatry. You say, well, this is a little weird. I mean, you're over here cutting off chicken heads and you're talking about, we don't do that in America. Well, it's just a different brand of idolatry. We just have different things we worship and we prop up as the sole places where we get joy, comfort, life, health, being. All you have to do, and I know it's a very whatever, it's a hobby horse, it's a go-to kind of thing, but all you have to do is palpate the life-changing disappointment when Alabama loses to Auburn. I mean, palpable. Mourning, ashes, sackcloth, depression. Don't want to get up and go to work the next day. Don't feel like going to church the next day. I just feel sick about all this. I just can't do it. For a football team, not even a professional paid football team, a college football team, 18 to 21 year olds who are working on degrees. That is idolatry. Oh, well, we don't like that. That's a little mean. I don't like that. Well, here's the deal. I'll just blow it out because it's different for all of us. But anything that can dominate your emotions so much that it can depress you based on the outcome of it, that's not God, is idolatry. Anything that you funnel a majority of your finances into, and you do it for, and I don't say that because then people say, well, my mortgage, I don't give $1,600 a month to the church. Well, we'd have a different church if you did, but the idolatry in that is that you look at what you funnel your amounts of money into, okay? You look at how much money you put into games. Look how much money you put into activities. Look how much money you put into sporting events, concerts, whatever it may be. Man, I'm going to go to every single, I don't know who it would be. I don't even know, I'm so disconnected from entertainment people that I can't even think of somebody. But here you go. Justin Bieber. There you go. I'm going to follow Justin Bieber for the rest of my life. I'm going to put all my money into Justin Bieberism. And everywhere he goes, I will go. And when Justin Bieber, tweets about retiring, I'm going to lose my mind. That's idolatry. Okay? Whatever is not God that you find as the ultimate source of your joy and happiness is idolatry. Well, I find that my job is what just makes me who I am, that I have to be captain of industry, CEO, Fortune 500. This is what I am seeking with all of my life, energy, and money. Doesn't matter if I sacrifice my family. Doesn't matter if we go broke. Doesn't matter if I'm sacrificing church or study time with God or anything. Well, guess what? Congratulations. If you were questioning about what your idol is, you found your idol. So whatever it may be, we kind of throw that one off as like, oh yeah, well, we're not cutting chicken heads off, so we're good on that one, and chalk that off on my card, and now I can mark off idolatry, got that one under control. No, it's just different. America, we just put idols in different places. So we have to kind of examine ourselves and look at that and say, okay, what am I investing? Am I investing more time in my job? And now in some situations, you can't help it, okay? And again, that's not an excuse. You could probably, there are ways you could help it, but I even look at when I was working as a nurse, you're working 312, got to work weekends, that includes Sunday. Sometimes it happens. Emily was working as a pharmacist, you know what? And thankfully, not anymore having to do this, but you just have to work on Sundays, okay? Sometimes the job at this point in life, where you're at, sometimes that is just your spot. Now, people who say, I choose to work on Sunday and miss church because it gives me whatever. Well, because there's a nursing shift, you can work all weekends. You get paid more money to do that. You just work weekends. You don't work any of the weekdays. Okay. So I choose that because I can get more money to do that. Well, but you don't get to go to church. Yeah, but that's idolatry. You're replacing God with something else. That the money portion of it is more important to you than getting that extra money, getting that extra whatever, having 4 to 5 days off in a row. That's more whatever it may be. We all change up and we do these things. We all have these little idols in our lives that we do. So we can't look at verses like this and just throw them out as being, well, that was just cultural for that point in time and yada yada. This is relevant to us. And he says, anything that replaces God as the source of your happiness, your joy, your peace, your comfort, your drive, your ambition, your whatever it may be, whatever replaces God in that way, that is your idol. And he says, so when we're sitting down and drinking and feasting and getting up and playing and having all this fun and it's not involving God, you know what? It's idol worship. Verse 8, he says, neither let us commit fornication, as some of them committed, and fell one day 23,000. Now, that's a lot of people. Numbers 25, verse 1, and it goes down through verses, almost down to 5 and 6. But what you have in that chapter, I won't go back and read it verbatim, but what you have in that chapter is that you have, after Israel got settled in their little area, you have the sons of Israel, which they told them, do not go and take wives and commit whoredom with the children of the Canaanites that were around you. He said, because as surely as you do this, he talks about it in Deuteronomy, as surely as you do this, they will entice you and they will pull you away from God. And in the end, you'll start worshiping idols instead of God. And guess what they did? Man, that Moabite woman, she is good looking. And so they still go off, and as he describes in Numbers 25 and verse 1, he says that the Israelites went amongst the daughters of Moab and committed whoredom. So they started gathering up the women over there. They were good-looking women. They started getting wives amongst them, even though God told them not to do it. And the very next verse says, and you know what? Then they started getting drawn off to worshiping Baal Peor, which is not God. So, you know, God says, you do this, it's going to do this. And guess what? He was right. Still applies today. God will say, you do this, this will happen. And guess what? He's still right. It doesn't change even today. So here he says, don't commit fornication like they did. And because of that, a plague was sent amongst Israel. And guess how many people died? 23 to 24,000 of them died at that point in time. So the same thing with us. Now, again, we talked very specifically about fornication back in chapters 7 and 8, and we talked about what it is in singleness and in marriage, and we went through all those things, and I'm not going to go back through them in that literal physical sense, but also I want us to remember a verse that he brought up in chapter 7 or 8 where he says that when a man joins himself to a harlot, he understands that it's not just a physical thing, that there's a spiritual connection there that goes way deeper than just the physical. And so his point in that, and the same point that he brings up going back to Numbers chapter 25, you see the natural progression. When you go out and you commit fornication and you're not following or staying true to the commandments of God, it will lead you away from God spiritually. Yeah. Now, it doesn't mean that you go off and you go burn into hell, okay? But you can guarantee it. You can sign, seal, delivered. You can prove it 1,000 times over and 1,000 times again, just as the children of Israel did. As you start getting drawn away from the things of God, as you start committing fornication and getting involved spiritually, as he would say, with a harlot, in that sense that you're whoring yourself out in that way, just using Bible words, you're whoring yourself out in that way, well, go ahead and accept the fact that you cannot do that and be, you know, I'm super Christian guy following after God. I'm super devoted to him, super spiritual. I've prayed to God and I've talked with him about my fornication issues. Can't help how I am, but I'm still fiercely devoted to God. Well, that does not, to use country lingo, G and haw. It does not work. You are just deluding yourself and deceiving yourself and thinking that you can do those things. It doesn't work that way. It has a spiritual, deep impact on our lives, and it will draw you away. So he says, don't commit fornication in that sense. You look back at our example from the Old Testament, 23,000 of them died because of that. You think God is serious about it? You think he's serious about things like that? You think he's just throwing it out there? Hey, it'd be good. You know, casual sex here and there is not something I really agree with overly, but, you know, there's grace and forgiveness. Except for the fact that he killed 23,000 people because of it. So he's serious about that. And the church today should be serious about that. And we as Christians should be serious about that. And we shouldn't look at it and say, when we're talking about being a Christian and following after God, and talk about it and be like, oh, well, you know, it's just how it is and the times are changing and people are more whatever, blah, 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 blah. Or maybe our idols on TV are doing it and therefore we can do it because, you know, they seem to think it's okay. No, if God doesn't think it's okay and he thought it was so not okay that he killed 23,000 people about it, I think he's serious about it, don't you? Okay, well, here's the deal. We're not going to be able to get through the rest unless you want to stay here till 3. And my children probably won't let me stay here till 3, so let alone y'all. So we will continue. We'll pick this up next time, starting there in verse 9 and going down as far as we can. But go ahead and read through the rest of these and kind of look at them. Get your own thoughts about it. Get your own perception as far as reading it and studying it. And then when we come back next week or whenever the next time we get up here, hopefully we'll be able to go through the rest of these things. So God bless us.